You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling.
Excited to be back.
Yes.
We took like a week off.
Yeah, it's been a little bit. We're reading through Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. We're on section 68, which is titled just like about the last 10 other sections, Imagination and Lived Experience.
It's the exact same title as the last one.
Yeah, but we're learning a lot about imagination and lived experience. It's good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know, no real news to share, I guess. We expanded our carport. That was a big thing.
Yes, huge thing.
So I've been doing some housework. I finally successfully got the washing machine to drain onto a new eucalyptus tree, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
Reusing the water. We bought 4 chicks.
Yes.
4 new chickens. And other than that, things are good. Kids are good, right?
Yeah.
So we're excited to be back podcasting.
Yes, we are.
And we're going to dive right in, I guess, right?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
68, Machination and Lived Experience. What in its extreme oppositionality is thereby recognized in its belonging, in a belonging that itself first indicates, that which we still do not grasp because the truth of this true occurrence is as yet ungrounded. Okay. Would you like to?
That is a little confusing, isn't it? I think so. Let's read the paragraph right before this. Just to maybe give some context, because I feel like he might be lurching back toward that. Yeah?
Yeah. What does machination mean? That which is released to its own fettering. What are the fetters? The schema of thorough and calculable explainability, whereby everything draws equally close together to everything else and becomes completely foreign to itself. Indeed, altogether other to itself and not just foreign. The relation of unrelatedness.
Yeah, so I feel like what in its extreme oppositionality is thereby recognized in its belonging, in a belonging that itself first indicates that which we still do not grasp, because the truth of this true occurrence is as yet ungrounded. I feel like, he may be just talking about oppositionality to machination and lived experience. Oppositionality to the schema of thorough and calculable explainability. But he also might be talking about what in its extreme oppositionality to itself is thereby recognized in its belonging. Because he goes on in the prior paragraph to talk about through the schema of thorough and calculable explainability, everything draws equally close together to everything else and becomes completely foreign to itself. Indeed, altogether other to itself and not just foreign, the relation of unrelatedness. So I think just there's a certain sense in which imagination maybe eliminates oppositionality. But it could also be what in its extreme oppositionality, meaning the extreme oppositionality of machination and lived experience, is thereby recognized in its belonging. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think as we read on, maybe we'll get an inkling. But there's definitely a sense of extreme oppositionality, things in opposition to each other, are thereby recognized in a belonging. So they almost belong in that extreme oppositionality. And that belonging it indicates what we still can't grasp because the truth of this oppositionality is as yet ungrounded. So he seems to be indicating there's something we are unable to grasp because it's not yet grounded, that it has something to do with extreme oppositionality and its belonging to that oppositionality. So why don't we read on?
Yet we can meditate on this that belongs and thereby remain ever further from every sort of self-gaping situational analysis. How machination and lived experience.
Yeah, let me. So what is recognized in its belonging in this extreme oppositionality? So it's a question. And it's he's saying that we kind of can't grasp what is recognized in its belonging here. Yet we can, even if we can't grasp it, meditate on this that belongs. This which belongs in this or via this extreme oppositionality, and thereby remain ever further by meditating on this belonging. By that meditation, we can remain ever further from every sort of self-gaping situational analysis. And I think he's talking about kind of analysis of situations. That's what situational analysis would be. Self-gaping. I'm not really sure what that means. I mean, I guess gaping at oneself. Self-gaping situational analysis. So self-gaping situational analysis could be analyzing contexts in which the self exists and taking these situations and these environments and the contexts of the self as the self relates to itself and taking the analysis of these to be a kind of scientific end in itself. That seems to be a pejorative. That seems to be self-gaping situational analysis would be a way of isolating the self as a situationally embedded entity. And again, it's the self doing that analysis. So that harkens back to me everything drawing equally together, close to itself, and becoming completely foreign to itself. Self-gaping situational analysis is the self analyzing the self through a situational analysis that makes it foreign to itself. And its relation then becomes one of unrelatedness. So he seems to be really like bashing on certain kind of psychologisms here. And it seems that the opposite of this psychologism, this self-gaping situational analysis, is some kind of recognition of what belongs to extreme oppositionality. So let's keep going.
How machination and lived experience, in a way which is as such hidden at first and for a long time, indeed still hidden up to this hour, reciprocally drive each other to the extreme and thereby extend the deformations of beingness and of humans in their relation to beings, as well as to themselves, into their most extreme abandonment, and how in these deformations they now mutually drive toward each other and create a unity which all the more conceals what is eventuating in it, the abandonment of beings, by every truth of bang, and in the end, even by bang itself.
Yeah, would you agree with me that that seems to indicate that this what in its extreme oppositionality means the extreme oppositionality of imagination and lived experience?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I think then that retroactively, I think retrospectively, rather, really says that, so in the extreme oppositionality of machination and lived experience, which is in a sense a false oppositionality because they are causally linked and very much related, what in their oppositionality is thereby recognized in its belonging? What belongs in there? And what cannot be grasped? It seems to me the answer is Dasein or Bang. And we meditate on this. And then, so yeah, how imagination and lived experience reciprocally drive each other to the extreme and thereby extend the deformations of beingness. Yeah, so machination pushes lived experience to the extreme. Lived experience pushes machination to the extreme. They're kind of this self-motivating, self-catalyzing, self-extremizing duo that pushes everything, pushes each other to greater extremes. And in these extremes, there's a certain unity that conceals what is actually causing all of it, which is the abandonment of beings by every truth of bang. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. This event of the abandonment by being would be misinterpreted, however, if one were to see in it merely a process of decline instead of considering that it proceeds through its own unique modes of disclosing beings and disclosing their pure objectification, indeterminate, apparently backgroundless, and altogether groundless appearing. The merging of the natural, the appearing of the things themselves, to which certainly belongs that semblance of having no ground. This that is natural no longer possesses, of course, an immediate relation to Greek word for being, I believe. Instead, it is utterly posited on the machinational. On the other hand, it is prepared by the erstwhile.
Yeah, that word is actually physis.
Physis.
Otherwise known as nature.
Okay.
Birth, origin, quality, property. Yeah.
Okay. I'll back up then.
Yeah.
This that is natural no longer possesses, of course, an immediate relation to physis. Instead, it is utterly posited on the machinational. On the other hand, it is prepared by the erstwhile predominance of the supernatural. This discovery of the natural, ultimately of what can be made and dominated and given in lived experience, must one day exhaust itself of its own riches and become entrenched in an ever bleaker mixture of previous possibilities. So much so that this attitude of merely continuing the same and of imitating knows itself and can know itself less and less for what it actually is. Therefore, it believes itself to be all the more creative, the more it pursues its ending.
Yeah. So he starts by saying this abandonment by being, we would misinterpret it to see it as just a mere process of decline. So he's not saying that imagination and lived experience represent a kind of degradation or a failure of the human experiment. It proceeds through its own unique modes of disclosing beings and disclosing their pure objectification, indeterminate, apparently backgroundless, and altogether groundless appearing. So it presents beings through an objectification that determines them, and it denudes them of a background and of a ground, and it discloses them in their pure state. the emerging of the natural. So, you know, this is going to be a big, this is and has been a big idea for Heidegger and other thinkers in terms of, you know, when we talk about nature and the natural, what are we really talking about? The emerging of the natural, the appearing of the things themselves, to which certainly belongs that semblance of having no ground. So he aligns the phrase natural with things themselves, which is a, you know, philosophically long idea. You know, the thing in itself, the actual thing, the true thing, the natural thing. So those are concepts that kind of define a reality outside appearance, and are the goals of cognition and philosophy to get at the thing itself. But he says, what is natural, what is the thing itself, is it turns out to just be a semblance, or in a sense you could say a product of machination. This that is natural no longer possesses, of course, an immediate relation to physis, which, you know, I think physis here probably in Heidegger's mind means actual nature. Mm-hmm. Instead, it is utterly posited on the machinational. So in a sense, he's talking about fake nature, manufactured nature, manufactured reality, manufactured in its selfness. On the other hand, it is prepared by the erstwhile predominance of the supernatural. The erstwhile predominance of the supernatural, I think what he really means is that the thousands of years of emphasis or attention to the supernatural has prepared us for this new machinational reality, that it's just an extension of the idea of the supernatural. And again, supernatural versus natural. So I think he's really saying that the natural that comes out of machination and lived experience is actually a supernature. Mm. This discovery of the natural, ultimately of what can be made and dominated and given in lived experience. So that's a real delimitation of what the natural is. It's only that which we can make and dominate and give through lived experience must one day exhaust itself of its own riches, and become entrenched in an even bleaker mixture of previous possibilities, so much so that this attitude of merely continuing the same and of imitating knows itself and can know itself less and less for what it actually is. Therefore, it believes itself to be all the more creative and the more it pursues its ending. Yeah, does that all remind you of anything? Or I don't know.
I mean, it sounds like anxiety somewhere.
Oh, how's that?
I'm not sure yet, I guess, but.
Yeah, I mean, this assertion that the natural is somehow a fictitious idea or a semblance and not yeah. really what is true nature, or that there's a nature outside of this fake nature that people are calling natural. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's best not to think of trees and lakes and animals. I think it's in a certain sense, it's better to think of human nature, how we use that phrase, what is human nature. Mm-hmm. But it's probably even more appropriate to think of the natural as that which is taken to be, I guess in a sense, established fact, or things as they really are. And just claiming that there's established fact or that there are things as they really are is a little problematic and a little liberal. You hear it in phrases like, well, it's only natural that, right? Or the natural state of things. Mm-hmm. claims of inherency, claims of like what's natural for people to do.
Mm. Yeah.
These kind of things, you know, in a sense, it's identity. Mm-hmm. It's identitarian thinking because it's setting up this is that and then calling that that equality or that adequation a formula that represents a natural stratum that is mm-hmm. kind of outside of us mm-hmm. and that we, in a sense, take for granted, take mm-hmm. as grounded, take mm-hmm. as given. And I think Heidegger is saying here that givenness, that groundedness, that state of nature that we kind of rely on conceptually to be the way things are is just a product of machination. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a conceptual objectivity that we rely on, that we build other theories on, et cetera, and all of which separates us from physis and bang. Which is a far more, how should we say, fluxy theory of what is and what is natural and what nature is. And, you know, I think when you run across people like we just did, we had some friends in town who really have a solid theory of the way the world works. How people work, what's true, what's false, what's right, what's wrong, what their identity is versus other identities, what other identities are doing versus their identity. And my favorite is what the opposition's motives are. Yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, these people we just spent a little while with, you know, have a very thorough sense of the natural, and by which I mean a very thorough sense of mm-hmm. a substratum of reality, objective reality that they've determined is a given, not to be debated, not to be questioned. And that's the nature on which all of human civilization kind of operates. Mm-hmm. And you don't question the nature of mm-hmm. things. Because they get very defensive, they get very upset, because then you're really undercutting the objective reality on which all their ideas are built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's why they believe themselves to be all the more mm-hmm. creative, the more it mm-hmm. pursues its ending, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. By pursuing its ending, it's not creative. Mm. But the more it pursues its objectives, pursues its defense of what is natural, the more creative it thinks it is. Mm-hmm. And the more it becomes entrenched in an ever bleaker mixture of previous possibilities, like mm-hmm. all its possibilities are already established and you don't dare suggest other possibilities. Mm-hmm. And it merely continues the same and it knows itself, and the more it knows itself, the less it knows itself for what it actually is. Mm-hmm. Now, does that remind you of our guests?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yes. Yes. Yeah, the last line, the more creative, the more it pursues its ending, is really an interesting idea.
Yeah.
All
right, go ahead.
I feel like there's one more paragraph. We should read it.
Oh, in this section? Sorry for going on. Go ahead.
No, is it? Am I right? Oh, yes, I am.
You're right, it is. Go ahead.
The coming together of machination and lived experience contains a peculiar event within the hidden history of being, yet there is no sign anywhere that the present era has the least knowledge of it. Or must it remain closed to this era and become the truth, the resonating of the truth of being only to those who are already in the transition?
Yeah. So I guess the coming together of machination and lived experience contains a peculiar event within the hidden history of Bang. So, I mean, I think I was waiting to hear what that peculiar event is.
Yeah, me too.
But I think it's the coming together of imagination and lived experience.
So that's different than it them being in extreme oppositionality. It's when they go from extreme oppositionality to together.
I mean, I think they are together in their extreme oppositionality. Oh, okay. I think it's kind of the same thing.
Okay.
And the present era has no knowledge does not have the least knowledge of it.
Yeah.
It remains closed to this era, or must it remain closed to this era? So it will remain closed, and become the truth, the resonating of the truth of being, only to those who are already in the transition from the first beginning to the other beginning. Mm. For me, you couldn't come up with a more powerful explanation of what we just went through. Mm.
This last paragraph in particular, or the whole section?
Yeah, I mean, just the way imagination. So again, right. We had some old friends here for a few days, and the experience with them was pretty, I don't know, what should we say, startling? They're very liberal. They're very angry. Angry, is that the word?
Yeah.
They're very upset. They're very sad about the state of the world. They're very convinced of their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And early in the trip, some ideas were put forward counter to their ideas, and they were devastated.
Yeah.
So it was a strange experience because it was just kind of like a lock was put on the conversation and we were not to talk of it anymore. I don't know. Yeah. The experience was just one of someone, I mean, you could see the machination. I think in that context, the machination is, it's good to think about this as an example, right? Right. Is that okay if I do that?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I think the machination is the theory.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the theory is, this is the way the world is working right now.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, we're talking about American politics, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Though with these people, it runs even deeper. But talking about American politics, and they have great, huge, grand theories of what's happening, of what the motives are of the people in the, shall we say, Republican Party or the Trump administration. They have a great aversion to all of them and everything they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so they have a lot of theories about what's happening. They have theory. They read. They get their news from certain sources. They have theories based on the foundational truths of those sources, and they're met and there's kind of no getting around that.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
But then their lived experience, I would say, is their sadness, their trauma, their sensitivity, their burden, the fact that the things that are happening are a threat to their very existence, to the very existence of their country, to the very existence of their person, to their very existence of their identity.
Mm.
And so the theory informs the lived experience, and the lived experience kind of defends the theory.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because what we experienced was, when you dared question the theory, then the lived experience was brought out as a way of saying, wait a minute, you don't understand how awful and traumatic
mm-hmm.
and it is for me for this to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't dare suggest that the theory might be wrong, because you're then not only denigrating and undervaluing and
it's a personal attack.
They take it personal. It's insulting, And it's threatening because you're threatening. So they've cohered the emotional and the theoretical, mm-hmm. and they've become the same thing. Mm-hmm. So when you attack the theory, you're attacking their emotions. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
so that's machination and lived experience brought together into a very cohesive and defensive structure of natural truth, of objectivity, and there's no move in it. It's mm-hmm. it's orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And long the short of it is, there's just, you're not allowed to question or talk to them about the, because all they do all day long, other than with us, is throw back and forth confirmations of their trauma, confirmations of their theory of the way the world is working with their friends and family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's one constant kind of Trump joke, I guess, or how would you put it? One constant kind of like, well,
Trauma experience.
Trump trauma, Trump dumb, Trump stupid, Trump evil, Trump blah blah blah. What a joke. What a mess. What a loser. What a dictator. You know, blah blah blah. Just like they do that all day long. And it's not only apparently assuages their grief and their trauma, but it reaffirms their theory. So they really operate in this echo chamber of affirmations mm-hmm. of and accusations,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that smells a lot like everything we're hearing in
mm-hmm.
here,
mm-hmm.
doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really great sort of way to think about. I had never quite put that together. And I'll say also, it really makes me think of the phrase that the personal is political.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
So it's like this idea that what's personal or emotional, or actually, that's not quite the idea. The idea is more just that like who you are is political, I guess. But mm-hmm. it takes it to like another level, uh-huh. perhaps, that's just like...
Uh-huh.
When the emotions and when it's like when your emotions are tied to a political narrative, it's sort of like, I mean, you always say like when our income isn't going so well, I'll get kind of down, and you'll always give the, what's the story that's like, I don't know, basically like, don't be down about that. Well, you have some story about it. What is it?
About getting down when your income is down?
Yeah.
I mean, I think the only thing I remember, I don't know if this story, but I had a friend whose dad ran a restaurant.
That's it, yes.
In Montana.
Yes.
And my friend, it was actually not his dad, it was his stepdad. So his mom's husband would come home every night. And if the receipts were good, he'd be in a good mood.
Yeah.
And if the receipts were bad, he'd be in a bad mood.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said watching that year after year was like, traumatic.
Yeah.
Some people are that way with like sports teams too.
Oh, yeah. Well, and with politics.
And with politics.
That's why
and
I
so
bring
the people
it
we're
up.
Talking about
yeah.
really are super depressed, and they're going to be depressed for 3.5 years. Now, the midterms, if they go the other way, might alleviate some of their depression, but by and large, they're depressed.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be anxious, traumatized.
And that, yeah, and just that interplay between the emotions and and the political is just really, that's really well said.
Right.
So how would you map that onto anxiety?
I mean, it seems that their whole political outlook is engineered and controlled by anxiety. I mean,
well, yeah.
I don't think.
I'm actually thinking like more like my anxiety, like the kind of anxiety we talk about that's not as political.
Well, yeah. Well, let me finish what I was gonna say. That's okay. Yeah. I mean, I think that. I think they have the politics they have because they're anxious. Mm-hmm. So I think the anxiety comes first. As mm-hmm. I've said all along,
yes.
liberalism is simply the political order that emerges from a massive anxious population. And their anxiety creates liberal politics.
Mm-hmm.
So, and liberal politics thereby also it feeds and exacerbates their anxiety, because liberal mm-hmm. politics is essentially a fundraising machine. And so it needs anxiety to survive, and anxiety needs it to be alleviated. So it's a mm-hmm. it's a giant addiction. Now, in terms of your anxiety, I mean, or anxiety in general, I think it's important to, I guess, see that anxiety catalyzes and generates beliefs mm-hmm. that you take the beliefs to be anxiety, or you take the beliefs to be affirmations. Well, the beliefs are, you know, I think in the political beliefs of the anxious, there's the pretense, or there's the urge toward healing.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking to solve your anxiety through the establishment of a political order.
Mm-hmm.
But it only ends up exacerbating your anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So at the more non-political level, if you have anxiety and you go and you try to create a story or a diagnosis or a psychological order or a series of behaviors or a set of solutions or whatever, and then your world becomes your life, your world becomes fairly structured around
yeah.
those, the sensation of that alleviating your anxiety is a myth, and it actually just increases your anxiety. So I would say somehow there's... Mm-hmm. If we're going to talk about anxiety, we're going to talk about the alleviation of anxiety, which I'm not sure if that's even a good way to speak, but then we need to be careful and realize that so much of what is put forward as anxiety alleviating systems are actually anxiety exacerbating systems.
Yeah.
And so the first thing one needs to be careful of when establishing systems that are supposed to cure anxiety is to ask, what are the anxiety exacerbating factors or elements in that system, and how can I try to navigate this conundrum of what's supposed to heal anxiety actually increasing anxiety?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think ultimately it seems the first solution is to say, well, aligning one's anxiety reactions with external systems and coming to view one's anxiety as labile and causatively linked to the systems that one has built up around oneself mm-hmm. is probably a failed project.
Mm-hmm.
And that it might be that non-systems, non-structures, non-political formulations, and in fact, ridding oneself of the urge and the need for those
mm-hmm.
might be the way to start getting underneath the anxiety and kind of applying some kind of salve so that the anxiety chafes and grows a little less robustly,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an early idea, but...
Yeah, that's nice. And then... So how would, I guess, sorry, maybe I'm not hearing here or not quite getting there, but where would machination, so the lived experience, I think, with anxiety is exactly the same as was being discussed with political anxiety, the sensitivity, the drama, the threat to the self. Feeling depressed, emotional. I guess what I am kind of missing is how I mean, I guess the machination just is anxiety in a way. Like what the more pure anxiety version of machination is. That's not like liberal American politics.
Yeah, well, it does. I mean, when I said that these people have a very solid theory, mm-hmm. I was hearkening back to Heidegger's use of the word natural and objective, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And things in themselves. And mm-hmm. so while the theory that I was speaking of is you know, about the motives and likely outcomes of the political order. Mm-hmm. It's really still just a theory. It's a theory of what the intentions of people they've never met are, mm-hmm. what the information they can glean from unreliable news sources is, and what the probable outcomes are of events that they cannot determine and actually have no information, no solid reason to have any certainty of causal outcomes regarding.
Yeah.
You see, so yeah. They've got a huge, fantastical, bereft of being grid of what's not just why things are happening, which is super generally slippery and mm-hmm. wrong, but what the outcome of these things are going to be if mm-hmm. X, Y, and Z occur.
Yeah.
And that's all theory. That's all hypothesis. Story.
Yeah.
And it's projection. And
worst case scenario.
Worst case scenario diagnoses. And it's fantasy. Mm-hmm. But they take all of this as mm-hmm. absolute truth. Truth, at least enough of a truth such that they're already emotionally reacting to things that haven't happened because they've determined that they are not just possible, but they're probable.
Right.
Or in fact, I mean, they're reacting to the negative occurrences that would occur if X, Y, and Z happened. Mm-hmm. But instead of waiting to have the emotional reactions to what happens mm-hmm. after X, Y, and Z mm-hmm. happens, they're already having them.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So this machination, this theory, is bigger than just a theory. It's a whole projected world.
Yeah.
Of natural reality, objective truth, mm-hmm. none of which is natural, real, or objectively true, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but it becomes emotionally through lived experience and its relation to machination. Mm-hmm. So lived experience becomes the emotional reaction to fantasies. Mm-hmm. So it's really like that meme where, you know, the girl is up on the second floor and she's throwing all the guy's belongings out the window and screaming at him about, why did you cheat on me? Why did you cheat on me? And he's like, you know, honey, I didn't cheat on you. You just dreamed that I did. And mm. she's like, I don't care. It's the same thing. Mm. You know, it's living the reactions to a dream as if they're real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Right?
Yes.
And, So that, I think, really highlights the degree to which machination and lived experience are in a relationship. A self-destructive or mutually destructive or mutually beneficial mm-hmm. relationship. Mm-hmm. Mutually beneficial and mutually destructive are synonyms here because the goal is to destroy oneself and consider it a benefit, which is liberalism. But, mm-hmm. you know, they are in tandem with each other. They're in a dance. And so again, the lived experience is not it's put forward as a reaction to the machinational theory. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it's there to defend the machinational theory. Mm-hmm. You don't question the machinational theory because you're then really doing the forbidden, which is questioning whether someone's emotions are valid or not. And that's not allowed in our current religious space. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So therefore, what you need to ask yourself is, in what sense is my anxiety a part of an emotional empire that I've established that is not only there to defend my theories, but mm-hmm. is there as a fictional reaction to fictional theories? And so then you need to say, well, what are those theories? And that's why reading Heidegger and deconstructing how one imagines mm-hmm. and posits the natural order of the world mm-hmm. is really critical mm-hmm. because it generates anxiety. Mm-hmm. It not only comes from anxiety, but it feedbacks to anxiety. It supports anxiety. And, you know, which is what I've always kind of said is I think, I mean, maybe it's cognitive. What's the phrase for that kind of therapy? The cognitive behavioral, whatever. Yeah. The only way out of anxiety is to rid yourself of the thoughts and systems and structures and machinational theories that perpetuate your anxiety.
Yeah.
And it's not easy, and they're hard, and it's not just philosophical analysis. It's a deep, thorough, long look into what your intellectual assumptions are. And how your emotions and your thoughts are feedbacking through into each other in ways that you can't even currently grasp, as Heidegger says. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's really just like, how does the world work? Because like with the people we just hung out with, mm-hmm. the world works for them in very specific ways. Like mm-hmm. you can say to them, well, you know, I don't know if Trump doing that is going to be, you know, everything you think it is. And mm-hmm. then they'll say, well, actually, it's going to be more than we think it is. It's going to be like the death of the country. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to mm-hmm. be like they're already living. Mm-hmm. They're already living the a country, massive, yeah. exaggerated.
Yeah, right.
Conflagration or apocalypse. They're already living an apocalypse.
Yeah.
So to be living in the midst of an apocalypse that hasn't yet happened, that you have no real reason to think will happen, mm-hmm. you can fantasize it will happen. You can come mm-hmm. up with reasons for it happening, mm-hmm. but you're not being a scientist. You're being a self gaping fearmonger. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can live in the midst of that apocalypse, even though that apocalypse has yet to happen. But that will be anxiety inducing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So at that level, what we're really talking about is things that have not yet happened.
Yeah.
Only have a relationship to you through various causal assumptions about their likelihood. And about the mechanisms that would actually bring them to occurrence.
Yeah.
But if you really analyze that network, that deep meshing of causal assumptions, you start to see that there's not a lot of ground there. There's not a lot of validity. There's not a lot of solid thinking. There's not a lot of science going on. Mm-hmm. It's really just emotional fear-mongering. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to divorce your thinking mm-hmm. from these kind of worst case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's really well said. That's a really fascinating.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe we shouldn't read anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean...
Yeah. I mean, is there more?
No, I wasn't thinking further. I was wondering...
Yeah, I was thinking maybe we should just keep talking a little more and we could have an episode that's like around an hour long.
Yeah, perfect.
Wouldn't that... That would be so commercial of us. Maybe we'll finally have an audience. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just looking back at the reading we did and thinking about it in terms of what we just talked about.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I think, like, for instance, his thing, we can meditate on this that belongs. Let's look at this. What in its extreme oppositionality is thereby recognized in its belonging? In a belonging that itself first indicates that which we still do not grasp, because the truth of its true occurrence is as yet ungrounded. So, between machination and lived experience, present in their extreme oppositionality, like almost sort of between them,
mm-hmm.
or as a substratum in which they are embedded, there's a belonging. So, mm-hmm. so in a sense, it's you,
mm-hmm.
right? Or it's what is there below or beneath or outside or free of the machination and lived experience feedback cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And it belongs there. It belongs to you. It is a belonging and it's hard to grasp because it's not yet grounded, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we can meditate on it.
Mm-hmm.
And by meditating on it, we can remain far, we can stay away from every sort of self-gaping situational mm-hmm. analysis. So situational analysis, a new way of thinking of that is, like these people we're talking about, they're constantly doing a situational analysis of themselves.
Yeah, right.
What situation are we in?
Yeah.
What's the situation we're in? And their situational analysis is, in my humble opinion, looking at them, listening to them, deeply flawed.
Yeah.
Like they're not really actually doing a very good situational analysis mm-hmm. because their whole situational analysis is actually just future projections.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're making, you know, businesses do this all the time. They make sales projections.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we invest this money in this department and this mm-hmm. product, then we'll probably end up with this kind of thing and that. But if we cut some over here and then we shuffled that over to that site, then we would probably be able to sell this and we'd probably save some money here. So that would mean this money. Like they make lots of projections based on mm-hmm. those are situational analysis based and you know based on kind of metrics and numbers mm-hmm. and they're really I would almost say that that's like businesses tend to try to do that very conservatively
mm-hmm.
meaning you really want to try to make sure your projections are tight and mm-hmm. solid and grounded
mm-hmm.
these people their projections are an absolute mess
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
like you hear them and you mm-hmm. think okay you literally are not crunching the numbers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're not actually absorbing the data. You're not actually taking the time
mm-hmm.
to sort of do due diligence to your own ideas and the ideas mm-hmm. of others and the news you have. You're not actually even doing very thorough research.
Mm-hmm.
You're depending on very specific sources of information, mm-hmm. very biased sources of information. Mm-hmm. And then from all of that, you're then not even really extrapolating something that seems coherently true mm-hmm. from the limited evidence that you have. You're actually then just going and saying, we're screwed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like their conclusion doesn't even follow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, first of all, their analysis is shoddy, but then their conclusion doesn't even follow from their shoddy analysis. So the whole thing just goes south really fast.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah, so, well, that's totally... For me, like my anxiety as well. So like how liberals might put it on Trump, I feel like I put it on myself.
Yeah. I mean, sort of that's
more
right.
Personally directed anxiety.
Yeah, that's right. I think you've absorbed, I mean, I think we all have.
Yeah.
Liberalism has trained all of us to absorb some fairly, fairly shoddy situational analyses.
Yeah.
Assessing our situation, I'm not sure many of us do a very good job.
Yeah.
Because we're so biased.
Yeah.
We're biased. We want, I mean, sometimes we're incredibly motivated to declare our situation as fatal and futile and fucked.
Yeah.
And other times we're, you know, motivated to say our situation is just brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just going so peachy.
Wait, who does that?
Well, meaning like sometimes overestimate the good that's happening. You're too positive.
Yeah.
Take my cancer. Remember that?
Wow. Yeah.
Huh?
Yes, that was a pretty specific situation
Situations are specific.
Well, yeah, that ahead. Was literally a malpractice situation that you like wanted.
Yeah, but I mean, but I didn't want to admit that I had cancer. Or I didn't want to be tested for cancer. I think unconsciously I didn't want to be tested for cancer. So I was overcompensating and I was over positivizing my situation and being like, oh, you know, it's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't need to get tested. Oh, this doctor's probably right. Oh, you're right. We don't need to do a biopsy. Oh, forget it. Yeah. And I'd chat and I'd talk and I'd be like relieved that we hadn't actually tested. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so like that example, okay?
No, it's fine.
No, you don't like it. So let's come up with a different example. What I said was sometimes people
project negatively,
and sometimes people project over positively.
Okay.
Meaning they have too rosy a view of the circumstances.
I think my position
that's the case.
No, that exists sometimes. I think in general, world.
Hold on. I don't think you ever do that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But that doesn't mean you have the right to deny that happens.
I agree. No, I said it happens. I said it's fine. All I'm trying to say is that I think that liberalism tends to have a more depressive, negative outtake.
Since November 5th, 2024. Yes.
Yes. Sure.
But liberalism can also have a very positive outtake. For instance, they thought we had this incredible president from 2020 to 2024, a cognitive masterpiece, the new Roosevelt, the new FDR, a man who was going to change America, a man who was delivering on America's great promises, and he was actually turned out to be an acognitive vegetable human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean,
that's a good point. Yeah.
Talk about liberalism putting on the rose-colored glasses. Is that the phrase? And seeing what was not there. And then all of a sudden he steps up in the debate and proves that he's a dead rat.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh gosh, we were not seeing what was right in front of us.
Yeah.
We were being too positive. I mean, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. No, that's true.
Okay.
That's a good example.
So, I mean, I think you tend to equate liberalism with depression and negativity.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
But liberalism has facets of huge celebrations, huge positivity, huge excitement, orgies of positive reaction to a host of identitarian, communitarian, controlling events.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, liberals could not be happier that we have racialized everything.
Mm-hmm.
It just thrills them to no end.
Mm-hmm.
That every college campus has groups hundreds of groups, each dedicated to some specific little identity that feels it needs to have this little identity click to represent itself. And to them, that's just like orgiastic progress. Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And when they see that, they think, ah, progress. Like liberalism gets really excited about progress.
Right, right.
It rarely is progress, but they get really excited about
it.
Yeah,
Heidegger has some great phrase about progress.
And so they feel really super positive about it.
Well, then I feel like somewhere in my anxiety, there's got to be that kind of positive rose-colored glasses, and maybe that's when I'm like, oh, my anxiety is not here or something. Yeah. Is that what I take?
I mean, I'm trying to discover your aversion, the source of your aversion to the idea. I mean,
well, just because I can't think of anything positive in my anxiety.
Well, I didn't say there's something positive in your anxiety. I mean, I said that liberals have emotions of depression and they have emotions of elation.
Yeah. Yes.
All of which are basically triggered by outside events.
Yeah.
Right? So when Obama wins, there is elation.
Yeah.
When Trump wins, there is depression.
Yeah.
Now, with you, if we want to talk just about you, when your anxiety is not there, you are elated.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When your anxiety is there, you're depressed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I hate to say it, but like sometimes there's Obama and sometimes there's Trump.
Yeah.
And I think what you experienced in our friends is this what seemed to be kind like a kind of a tragic, almost infantile state of being, where whose president drastically and foundationally controls their emotional tenor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little odd to see. It's a little, it's a little creepy to see. Not creepy. It's unfortunate. It's like, wow, like you've handed over your innards.
Yeah. Right. Right.
To current events.
Yes. Exactly.
And so I think that you too have handed over your innards.
Yeah.
To current events.
Yeah.
But those current events, maybe they're not political. Maybe they're just like,
yeah.
Maybe they're just the current events inside of you. You've handed over your innards to your own unpredictable state of being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. To like what I notice.
Yeah, that's the right.
Objects I like or don't like, that's or just thoughts I like or don't like.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. 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 Like you operate on the assumption that the world has something to do with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have something to do with the world. So you're constantly monitoring it for how it's going.
Yeah.
What it has to offer you, what you think you can tell about its direction, its likelihoods.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets you really caught up in a sporting event that you can't control. And so when your team wins, you're like, yeah. When your team loses, you're like,
Arr. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
So I think, leave the world.
Yeah.
Let it go.
Mm-hmm.
It's not there for you and you're not there for it. It doesn't have the control over you that you think it does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even most more importantly, it's not headed in any direction that you'll ever be able to figure out.
Yeah.
So you have to stop trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, you know, really the most shocking part of hanging with our friends was, you know, when I would say one little thing like, well, you know, I consider, you know, this Trump action to be somewhat merited given the circumstances. And their reaction was essentially, well, but Trump doing that will literally mean the country is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like, well, where's the country going if it's gone? Like, mm-hmm. where is it going?
Mm-hmm.
Is America moving to Thailand?
Mm-hmm.
Or is America all of a sudden going to like not be called America and change? Mm-hmm. It's just, you can't even understand what it's gone means. And it, yeah. So is it gone forever? Or is it just gone for a year?
Yeah.
Or what has, you know, and it's just such magical absolutist thinking.
Yeah.
But I think, I think that goes on even in you.
Oh yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Not about that specific topic, but.
Yeah. Magical absolutist thinking. Definitely. Yeah.
And all because you were trained to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a very important fact because it's like,
right.
That's not, you know, again, mm-hmm. going back to, that's not your natural state.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how you have to be. Mm-hmm. That's not how you were born to be. That's mm-hmm. not your constitutional makeup.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the organic manifestation of your genetics.
Right.
There's nothing absolute, given, grounded, true, ultimate, you know, unchangeable about any of that.
Yeah.
But instruction is instruction. Imprinting is imprinting. Being raised by liberals is incredibly confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly deluding.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly disinforming.
Mm-hmm.
It's as Heidegger says, to be raised by liberals, okay, is to be released into your own fettering.
Mm, yeah.
Okay. It's to be born and to have people say to you, guess what? You are free.
Mm-hmm.
And you head into that freedom and you look around you and everywhere you are in chains.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Liberalism has no interest in freeing you.
Mm-hmm.
None.
Yeah.
It wants you in its army. And if you won't join its army, that means you're in the other army.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to point its gun at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the way it works. Liberalism is a war machine.
Yeah.
So you got to get out of it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? One more. Say something else.
Yeah, I think I like this idea that, I mean, I think everything you said is absolutely right. And I think I like this idea that yes, it's been a long training. And then thinking about what's natural, or I guess it's what is it, physis? Like, what is it that is outside there, beneath there, concealed within that?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Thank you. That was really great.
All right. I think that's it. That was section 68.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.